Blog Talk Radio.
So have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up. From Los Angeles, a big LA welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I am Dave, the caregiver's caregiver on the Dave Nassani Network, coming to you through the famous worldwide blog talk radio. Yes, folks, I'm the guy who's going to help you, guide you through this very difficult journey called caregiving, and we're going to do our best to help you avoid all of the obstacles that will keep you from avoiding that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. Because when you don't put your mask on first, just like the airlines tell us, in the event of a loss of cabin pressure and the oxygen mask falls from the ceiling, put your mask on first before you attempt to put the mask on of your small child. And that's the reason for that silly rule, folks. They know that if you don't do that, you're going to black out and you won't be any help to anybody. Now, we're also talking about loss today and the devastating effects that it can have on us. It automatically enters into this thing called the grief process, which we will be talking about today. The only way out of the grief process, folks, is to go through it. And hopefully, we will help you do that if you happen to feel like you're stuck in it. Well, I'm so excited today because we've actually survived our first two shows, even though we were plagued with a host and a variety of technical difficulties, which is pretty common, I'm told. Fortunately, all in all, the shows went just fantastic. You can listen to them as recorded podcasts by going to the same links. Lisa DeLong and Sandra Champlain did phenomenal jobs, and I want to thank them for blessing our listeners. Now, this is our third program of Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, Avoiding Burnout and Surviving Grief. We have another very special guest today for the first hour, best-selling author, speaker, entrepreneur, music entertainment coach, and real estate broker of her own company, Lynn Barrington. Now, we will attempt to take some callers after our first break. If you promise to keep your questions to our topic of practical tips for surviving grief and avoiding burnout, and we're going to be talking about something called Caregiver Plan B. We'll tell you all about that in a moment. The call-in number is 213-943-3630. And just push the number 1 on your keypad. That tells me that you want to talk. For those of you who do not press the number 1 on your keypad, that tells me that you are just calling into the show to only listen. Because maybe there's no internet. Maybe there's no computer. Maybe there's no smartphone. Or maybe you're just driving down the highway having a good time. Hey, if this is your first time tuning in, you can go to my website, DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com, or if that's too much for you to type, remember, you can go to my shortcut, DaveNass, that's N-A-S-S, .com. That's Dave Nass, and that's the first four letters of my last name. Either one will get you there. All right, enough of that. Welcome, Lynn.
Hey, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. If it was any better, I just couldn't stand it.
That's great.
So you're from Nashville, Tennessee, country capital of the world. What's it like in Nashville?
Oh, it's awesome. Actually, I live in a little burb called Franklin, and it's a very cool place. And we got our sweet little downtown Franklin that you've probably seen on American Pickers, actually. One of the guys lives here, and I just love it here. It's just great. Great people, great environment, and especially great food.
Well, it must be great because you almost talked me into moving down there after you showed me this beautiful mansion on 1 acre of land, lush green.
Yeah.
I think it was, how many square feet was it? And it was only $500,000. Wow.
Yeah. It was pretty good. Compared
I'm glad
to the
I didn't do it to the economy.
California.
Say that again?
I said compared to the prices that you guys pay in California, So, yeah, it's quite a bit of property compared to what you have to pay there. So,
yes.
But you did the right thing.
I did. I did. You know, there's just no price you can put on California sunshine.
Well, that's the truth. That's the truth. I love California, and I miss it every day.
And I miss you, Lynn. Lynn and I first met in Nashville when I was looking to buy some property down there, and some very good friends and my cousin recommended her as a commercial realtor, and that's how we got introduced. Lynn found us some property down there, and we have just been blessed with each other ever since. I am so glad that I have her as a lifelong friend. Now let's get down to business.
Well, and vice versa. I'm happy I have you and Charlene especially as my lifelong friends, for sure.
You are so sweet. Now, you used to be a caregiver, right? In your introduction, you called yourself a Plan B caregiver. Can you kind of explain exactly what you mean by that? And if you yourself have ever experienced caregiver burnout or saw the effects of it in others, and some tips you might have on how we can all avoid it?
Sure. Well, a Plan B caregiver is, basically I just made that name up. You know, I haven't seen it on the internet or anything, but that's really the caregivers that are not the primary caregiver and are caregivers. And basically how I came up with that is my mom, my brother had just died, and my mom became sick, and the caregiver that we had checked out. And so my other brother was at the hospital all the time with my mom, and so he would do 2 weeks, then I would fly in and do 2 weeks, and then fly back to Nashville, then he'd do 2 weeks, and I'd fly back in. And it just seemed like that, you know, I was the Plan B caregiver. And even though that I, at the time I was flying in and doing my 2 weeks, doing 24/7, I wasn't being respected. Not, you know, it wasn't that I had the primary decisions, even though I was making the primary decisions because I had medical power of attorney. And so, Dave knows me really well, and I'm pretty straightforward. And so I had to address that. You know, I had to address and say, you know, this can all work well if, you know, as a Plan B, instead of being right there at the location all the time, you know, there's given both ways, and we can use my living in another city as a benefit rather than a hindrance or a resentment in the whole process. So, and wow. You asked me if I saw caregiver burnout. Yes, and experienced it. Because
really?
When you're giving of yourself 24/7, I mean, it's only a natural thing. I think sometimes people respond, as far as the effects of it, people respond differently. Everybody responds differently. And I think there's many different ways you can avoid it. You know, probably the best way to avoid caregiver burnout is probably three different things. One is you've got to be able to accept help and not resent it. That would be the first thing. And to ask for help. Many caregivers just take kind of an unhealthy ownership of the care receiver, and they won't ask for help. They don't speak up. You know, they don't want to spread the responsibility, or they don't want to check in with others because really they don't want anybody else's opinions in the situation. And so all the responsibility goes on the caregiver if they don't open themselves up. I think that's one really strong way to avoid it, is to ask for help. A second thing, and that was hard for me because I'm a fix-it, and that's hard for my brother because we're fix-it people. We take on the responsibility, and it's up to us to fix it. Then the second thing that you can do, I think, is give yourself a break. You know, try to set aside at least 30 minutes every day for yourself. Just go in and stand in the shower. You know, people don't seem to bother you if you go to the bathroom. You know, it's the one place people actually still have respect for you. So go into the bathroom and take a shower, take a long bath or something like that. Just get away for a moment. Or, you know, again, go back to the asking for help and ask somebody to come over and see if they can stay for an hour. And, you know, one of the things that I did is I would, because I didn't live, my family lived in Odessa, I would get in my rent car and go to, there was a place that was, in West Texas is very desert-like, but there was this place where there's this pond. Actually, it was at the university there, University of Texas at Permian Basin. And I'd go, and I would just drive, and I would sit in front of that water for just 30 minutes. And it calmed me and kind of shifted my brain a little bit. And then I think another thing you can do is you can laugh. You know, if you lose your humor in the caregiving thing, you know, all is lost pretty much. It's just you've got to be able to laugh at things. And so I think those are some practical ways you can avoid it. I mean, there's many, many more. But
that's great advice.
I think the last thing, too, is that you have to keep your own health up. Because if you go down, then who's going to take care of the care receiver? So it's really important, if you've got health issues, to stay up and go to your doctor, do exercise, eat properly, and don't, you know, eat bad stuff or, you know, drink too much or take too many drugs.
Well, you can eat a donut or two, though, can't you, just to break the monotony?
Well, I mean, if it was me, you know, I'm allergic to gluten. But, you know, if during that time, you know, I'm not good with eating one donut. You know, I'm good at eating a dozen donuts, but one, it didn't work for me so well. It's either zero or a dozen for me. So that all that kind of stuff, you have to, you know, logically go in and go, if I eat that first one, I'm going to eat that whole dozen. So I think I'll go and have me a smoothie, and then I'd get my sugar fix in a healthy way. It's making your mind up that you're actually going to take care of yourself, that you actually are just as important. In fact, the caregiver, the primary caregiver and the Plan B caregiver, they are really, really important. Their bodies are actually more important at times than the care receiver, because if you go down, then the care receiver is stuck.
Yeah, just like the airlines say. Well, that's great advice, especially the laughing part. You know, Charlene and I have been going through our thing for 18 years. You know, she can't speak, hasn't spoken, only knows a handful of words. But she communicates very well, because communication is 80% nonverbal. And she's got that nonverbal part down pretty good. And I'm always making jokes, and I'm always cracking jokes. And sometimes when we're around other people, it shocks them. It takes them by surprise that you know, we're being funny and we're being normal and we're laughing and we're poking fun at each other, you know, in a nice way. I mean, we're not being mean to each other or anything. But, you know, if I wasn't lighthearted and had a sense of humor, you know, I don't know what I would have done. But I just – and it works. I mean, I feel like I have a normal wife, a normal life, a normal marriage. And, you know, I'll look and I'll see people, you know, like feeling sorry for me. Oh, that poor guy, you know. But, you know, don't feel sorry for me. I'm doing great. God has given me the grace to go through this and the sense of humor. So I'm fine. It's not easy, but, you know, we can do it. And
that's right. And Charlene herself has a great sense of humor, especially about you.
She does.
I mean, a lot of people don't know you, Dave. You know, they're just learning about you on this radio show. And Dave's a great guy. He's a super guy. But he's also, you know, he's got his own quirks, you know, just like we all do. And she's so great, because she'll just go, you know, and then start laughing. Like, you know, forget it, you know, whatever, you know. She's got such a great sense of humor about you, you know, because as a primary caregiver, he gets going in a certain way. And let me tell you, if she does not want to go that way, I can promise you Charlene will let you know. And if he thinks he's going a certain way and he's not going, he just hadn't figured it out yet, she lets him know that too. And that's when it's really the funniest. Is that he thinks he's going that way, and she's like, oh, no, you're not going that way, buddy. You're not going down that road. You're going down my road. So she gets him there. So she's got a great sense of humor, and it's so much fun to be with them, and I really miss getting to be with you guys. And, you know, we've had some big laughs. You know, I've had just as many big laughs with Charlene as I have Dave. So it's huge. I think it's huge for the whole stressful situation.
And, you know, an example just the other day, you know, our dishwasher broke, and of course I had a repairman come out, and it almost cost as much to fix it as to buy a new one. And of course I want to fix it, and she goes, no, we're buying a new one. I says, well, we're only going to spend this much. She goes, no. So we're at Sears, and the ladies, little lady, you can imagine, the, you know, and I'm saying, no, not that one. She goes, no, I can't open this one. You know, I'm paraphrasing, of course. And then after like 10 minutes, the lady says, you guys are a crack-up, you know, because we're just bantering back and forth. We're arguing about price, color, model, and the funniest thing that I say that usually cracks people up is, you know, she'll go through this thing, you know, nobody understands what she's saying, but obviously she makes it very clear with her actions and her body language and her tonality and her touch and her eyes that, you know, I'll just say, oh, well, why don't you tell me what you really think? You know, in other words, you were crystal clear. And so I always believed we could make a great comedy team, you know, just doing stand-up comedy with her as the straight man, you know. Anyway, let's move on.
Really,
we can talk about this all
really
day long.
You guys are really like Ricky and Lucy, except you're Lucy and he's Ricky.
That's true. Lucy, you got some splaining to do.
That's right.
All right. Let me move on to the next question. If you are a primary caregiver, like my audience out there, what can they do to use, like you just invented the term? I don't even know if you're allowed to invent a term like that, but I guess you did it, so I guess you're allowed to. What can you do to use a Plan B caregiver in a healthy way? There you
go. Well, I would say the first, let me just re-explain, just so we're all clear on the same thing, and I don't know who's going to stop who they is that could stop me from creating that, but anyway, so a Plan B caregiver is, if you're a caregiver, it's any, if you're a primary caregiver, a Plan B caregiver is your Plan B option. In other words, it's if it's your sister or if it's your aunt or if it's the, you know, neighbor down the street, it's anybody really but you. Since you're the primary caregiver, or if you and your husband are the primary caregivers for your mother, then it's anybody else. And so I would say the first thing that you can do to use a Plan B caregiver in a healthy way would be, the first thing would be, is to give them some respect, because Plan B caregivers are usually completely discounted. It's like no matter what they do, it's not as good as the primary caregiver does. No matter what they do, it's not appreciated. And so most Plan B caregivers don't live in the same town. They're usually away, or they're usually not part of the family or not counted as part of the family. And so whatever they give, it's usually discounted or not even appreciated at all.
Yeah,
and so
that's so true.
That went on for a little bit with me when my father was he had Alzheimer's, and so my stepmother was the primary caregiver, and then she passed away, and then then we had to put him in a home, and then my brother ended up being a primary caregiver, and so. Anything that I did, whenever I flew in or whenever I would call and talk to them, or it was just like not appreciated. And so that was the first thing, is that I finally had to address, listen, what I do is just as, it's not just as important, but it's really important. And you can actually use me in a very healthy way. So the first thing is to give your Plan B caregivers some appreciation and respect. Number two is not to resent them, because they have, they're not, you've the, you have most of the time chosen by your locality or by necessity to be the primary caregiver. So don't resent them because they live in another town. It's not their fault. That's where they live. And number three, decide that you're going to use them in a healthy way. In other words, in my mom's situation, when my sister-in-law was the caregiver, primary caregiver, because I lived out of town, Mom could call and vent with me, where they just didn't want to hear it because they were doing all they could physically and mentally do. They didn't want to hear her side of things. So, you know, that became a real help to them, and they finally kind of figured that out. And as they would vent, as my mom would vent, I would listen to her. Then I would call my sister-in-law and say, what's going on in this situation? So she would tell me her side. So then I'd call my mother back and say, well, now I understand how you feel here, but this is how they feel. And I would negotiate with the two, you know, people there living in the same home so that they would come to a good agreement. And so you can use your Plan B caregiver to negotiate things that because they live with you, they just don't want to deal with you about it. So there were things my mother would do for me that she would not do for my sister-in-law or my brother, just because she lived there and she was pissed off at them for some reason. So
well, I can totally relate to that.
They kept calling me the golden child. I really wasn't the golden child. Well, I kind of was, but I really wasn't the golden child. I was just not there every day. That's all. And so you can use your Plan B person to help make things smoother for you if you don't resent them. But if every time they come in and they try to help in any way, whether they try to send money, whether they spend time on the phone, whether they send gifts, if you resent that and you allow that resentful attitude as a primary caregiver, if you allow that to fester inside of you, then it's actually going to become another additional weight that you have to carry. So decide. It's just a decision. Just decide, hey, I'm going to appreciate them, whatever they can do. Just be grateful for whatever they can do instead of resenting. You have a choice. Be grateful or resent. It's always much better to be grateful.
It's true. Those kind of caregivers, and thank you for calling, putting a name on it, because I think that's going to be a new chapter in my new book, because that is so not talked about. You know, in fact, I was just reading online David Cassidy, who is a new caregiver to his mother with dementia, but yet he's a Plan B caregiver. He lives far away. He's busy with his job and career, but he manages to fly in once a month and spend some time with his mother. And I was reading some posts on the blog and from other caregivers, and it's like they were discounting what he did. You know, it's like it wasn't important. And, you know, he's not a real caregiver. You know, we're here 24/7. You know, that's a caregiver. But, you know, that kind of attitude can make that Plan B caregiver say, well, gee, they don't even appreciate what I'm doing, so I'm out of here, you know. But
yeah, why do it? Why help at all?
Yeah.
When in effect, you as a primary caregiver, remember going back to the things that I suggested earlier, you need all the help you can get.
That's
so
right.
Don't diss the help that you get. You know, appreciate
don't burn
it.
Your bridges, so to
That's
speak.
That's right. Right,
because you're going to need those people. You know, even to get away for dinner, or you know, we had a caller last week was telling me when she was a young mother, because she was a caregiver to her husband, and she says, you know, that was hard, but that was nothing compared to when I was a young mother raising three small boys. And I just remember crying, wishing that I could just go to Starbucks and have a coffee all by myself where I didn't hear, you know, baby talk. You know, I can actually converse with an adult just for 30 minutes.
Yes.
And it never happened, you know. So those of you who
right.
know young mothers with small children, they need a break, you know. Be a Plan B caregiver
right.
to them. And they're the most unappreciated caregivers ever, because it's like...
Of everybody, oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're a mother. You signed up for this. What are you complaining about? Do your job, you know. And,
right.
you know, it's hard being a mother. It's very, very hard. Well, that's a great, great answer, Lynn. Let's move on to the next question that I have for you. You've personally have had a number of close family losses in your life.
Yeah.
From your beloved mom to your daddy, and that's what they call fathers in the South. They call them daddy, don't they?
That's right.
To your very close brother Joe, who you lost, and your two adorable dogs, Otto and Ben. And, you know, I think our pets are probably right up there in importance, because they love us unconditionally. They don't judge us. They're happy to
right.
see us when we get home, like we've been away for a year. And most recently, your mom's sister, your aunt. Now, Lynn,
mm-hmm.
how do you survive blow after blow after blow like that? And how long did it take you to get through that grief process? I would think that it seemed like as soon as you were through grieving with one loss, that it would, like, start all over again.
Well, yeah, that's really, that's really true. In the case with my dad died in 2005, and I got through that, but that was really challenging because I just co-authored what became a best-selling book called Daddies and Daughters, and Daddies and Daughters is with Simon & Schuster. You can check it out on Amazon.com, mm-hmm. or you can go to my website, LynnBarrington.com, if you want to. We had just finished writing that, and I had to I was supposed to speak on that, and it was just too hard. In fact, losing Dad, I stopped writing for years. I just couldn't even write anymore. And then in 2005, my brother Joe passed away after 5 years of colorectal cancer. Well, Joe got colorectal cancer 6 months after Daddy died. So we went through that whole process for 5 years. He died in April the 29th of 2005, 90 days later to the day my mother died, and almost to the day, August the 9th. And then a few months later, my dog that I'd had 12 years died. So in 1 year, I lost my mother, my brother, and my dog. And so, you know, what happened for me is what happens for a lot of people who go through multiple losses is they either deal with it very severely or they don't. And I was one of those that I just kept going. After my mother passed away, that the following set, I put my mother in the ground on Sunday, and the following week I had the largest commercial deal that I'd ever had, and it closed on Friday, and I just kept going. And so I really didn't face it, and then I almost lost Otto in December, and he came back literally from death.
Yeah.
I just couldn't stand another loss, and he came back, and finally in February, the grief hit. And what I would say to you, if you've had one loss or if you've had multiple losses, I didn't face them. The first time with Dad, I faced it and I dealt with it appropriately. The second time when it became multiples, I did not deal with it well. I actually drank at my house by myself, and in public and every place else, because I was a best-selling author and a lot of people knew me here in town. Everybody thought I just handled it beautifully, but they didn't see me at home. So I drank secretly. And I remember on Easter in April, the night before Easter, I was sitting in my recliner with my dog just drunk. and was crying and crying out to the Lord and just said, Lord, help me. Help me. Tomorrow is resurrection day. Help me. Resurrect me from this kind of grief. Hit me so hard because I didn't start doing it immediately and taking care of myself immediately. I just kept going and not facing it. I just prayed and asked him to, and I was crying, and I remember Otto was licking my face, licking the tears off my face and just being right there. And that next day, I got up and went to church, and, it was just a supernatural thing happened. He lifted that grief off of me, and I didn't have that weight on me. And he heard my prayers, and I didn't drink at home anymore. And then right after that, I guess in June, after that Easter, Otto died. And I learned, Otto really hung in there for me. And I really think it was just helped me get through losing Mom and Joe. And I learned from that. And so a month later is when I got Ben and Jerry, my two little other dachshunds. And I really took care of myself, and I went ahead and cried when I was supposed to cry and grieve when I was supposed to cry, grieve on a daily basis. And you have to go through that crying and grieving, because if you don't and you pretend you can just keep going, it will hit. I promise you, it will hit. And then it's much worse. It's much worse if you delay it. So after that, it was a few years, maybe 8 years, and then I was in South Korea, and I had left Ben and Jerry here, and while I was over there, I was doing a tour with Jose Feliciano, and while I was over there, Ben died, and it about killed me. I mean, it was really tough, but again, I had learned how to grieve, and so when I got back here, I really took time. I took 2 months, just hanging out here with Jerry and grieving at the appropriate times. And that's not about just feeling sorry for yourself. It's about remembering and facing the days without that loved one, And, of course, like just what you said, the pets are, they're just as strong in your heart as humans, especially for me, I'm single. So that's my baby. And So it's been a real process of learning how to do that. But what I've learned is that, that you kind of don't know most of the time as a child because your parents protect you. But grief is a part of life. And if you ignore that grief, it becomes a much more powerful thing that is harmful. But if you embrace it and just go through it, then it becomes something palatable and actually it makes you grow as a human being and grow in your faith. So that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Wow. So do you consider yourself through the grief process? I mean, how long really did it take you to get over the grief of all those losses? Are you still grieving?
Well, I tell you, I cannot go to this day. Now, I can go to church on Father's Day. It didn't affect me the same way, but to this day, I went to church on one Mother's Day after about, Mom's been gone since 2005, so that's been 9 years this time. And I guess after about 5 years, I went to church on Mother's Day and just left and cried, and I just thought, why am I putting myself through that? Because she's my best friend, and she's just awesome. And so I just still don't go to church on Mother's Day, and I still cry. Usually the Friday and Saturday before, I think of my mom, and I cried. I miss her, and I miss my brother. I still miss them. And sometimes things will come up, or songs will come up, or TV shows, or like my brother Joe. He was an artist, and he grew up. He actually had art lessons from Stan Lee because he loved cartoons and he loved all of the Marvel comics. And so I grew up reading his Spider-Man and Fantastic Four and the Hulk and I read all those comic books, so every time one of those come out, like Captain America just came out, X-Men come out this weekend, and I go most of the time to see those Marvel shows by myself or with a friend or two that knows this about me, but because it's kind of like time with my brother, because he would have loved it. So there's still a part of your life, and I think that's especially if you know that they have accepted Jesus Christ as Lord and they've gone to heaven, then you know that that is that you're going to see them again. They're still part. My daddy is still part of my life. I see pictures of him, and I hear things come out of my mouth that I learned from my daddy. And the same thing with my brother or my mom, or I still think of Otto. I was thinking about him the other day. I saw a picture. And I was just thinking about his personality and how he helped change me. Those our old pets, they change us and make us more caring because they're so loving. So, I think the mistake sometimes people try to do is they try to keep their family in the past. But in reality, your family, the loved ones, your sweetheart that maybe you've lost, or your boyfriend that you've lost, or your girlfriend that you've lost, or that person that has affected your life you've lost. They affected your life. They changed part of you. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. So you carry that with you. You don't ignore that and just put it in the past and pretend it didn't happen because you can't deal with it. If you embrace it, it becomes easier to walk through life with rather than without.
Wow. That is awesome. Let's talk about, we're talking about the grief process, which for most people it starts with denial. This isn't happening to me. And then when they realize it is happening to me, they get angry. And, that anger may come out to caregivers. I know with Charlene and I, there was no one else for her to be angry at but me. And so I bore the brunt of the anger, and it's not easy to receive other people's anger. And that was the hardest part of my being a caregiver, is that first 2-year process, because it took her a couple of years to get through the grief. And I needed lots of breaks. And thank God for my mother-in-law, because she moved in with us and she took a big load off. So for a period of time, I was the plan B caregiver. And, while she was there, and then they finally, moved back to where they came from with all their friends. And I became the primary caregiver again. But, yeah, next stage is bargaining, where we either try bargaining with the individual or with God or whatever. And then, when we realize that we tried this and we tried that and we tried that and we're stuck in this and it's not going away, we can't get out of it, then we come to the most perhaps devastating grief, and that's depression. Can you talk about depression? I mean, it's a big issue with caregivers. You've shared with me and given me permission to share with our audience that you were clinically depressed for years, over a decade. How did you cope with that? Are you still dealing with depression today?
Well, I've got a great story for you about the whole depression thing. My depression didn't come from loss. It was chemical depression, really clinically depression. Clinically depressed. And I grew up in a time where, I didn't even really know what depression was, didn't think about it. I mean, it hurt, you hear stuff, but, I just didn't think of it as me seriously. And then one day I was I was at home. I lived in California, where I lived for 15 years, and I was in Pasadena. And a beautiful Southern California day. I was at home on a Saturday. I had the lights off. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, if that late. And I had the lights off. The blinds were closed. I was watching TV under a blanket, eating bonbons.
Sounds good so far.
And, I know. The door knock. I hear the door knocks, and I was like, yeah. And it was my friend Carmen Berry who, we ended up co-authoring Daddies and Daughters together. She's a New York Times bestselling author who wrote the book Girlfriends and many books. She's really, really smart gal. But at the time, she had written this book called When Helping You Is Hurting Me.
Yeah.
And so she has two master's degrees in social work. I mean, I can't remember the names of the degrees because it's
sociology.
Way smarter than not even. Well, it's way smarter than I am. So
above your pay grade, huh?
Yes, above my pay grade. And so she knocked on the door, and I come out in my pajamas, and so she comes in. She goes. She's sitting over in the chair, and I'm still looking at the TV, but we're talking. I'm looking at the TV. I go, "You want some bonbons?" No. And she goes, "Lynn," she goes, do you see something wrong with this picture?" And I went, "No." You know, I wasn't laughing. I was just like numb. I was numb. And she was like, "Lynn, you're depressed. You're clinically depressed." And I went, "Well, what is that?" I mean, I didn't know what she's talking about. To me, it was like Chinese. And so she said, "Listen, I'm not going to just sit here and watch you go down the tubes. I'm not just going to watch it." So she got up, she opened up the blinds. I'm like, going, "Why are you letting the sunshine in?" I still didn't get it. And she goes, "I want you to get dressed. I'm going to take you over to a clinic, and you're clinically depressed." And I started crying, and I went, "I don't know why you're saying I'm depressed. I'm saying this, you know, like I'm crying, you know." So I get dressed. She goes, "Listen, you're either going to come with me or I'm not going to watch it. I mean, you're going to lose me as a friend." She made it clear that I would lose a friendship unless I did what she said. And she's real important to my life. And I was like, "Well, okay." So we went over, and I remember I met Dr. Terry Langford. And Dr. Terry was over at UCLA, brilliant psychologist doctor, and she was working at this clinic on Saturday. She'd go there once a month, and she happened to be there. And so we went in, and so Carmen came in with me, and I was like, "I don't even know why I'm here. Why are we here?" You know, and one of my things about people didn't know I was depressed is because I'm funny. I can be really funny. And so Carmen and her went into all this, you know, psychological talk. And I was like, "What are you guys talking about?" You know. And so she started asking me questions, you know, questions like, you know, "Have you ever thought of killing yourself?" And I go, "Well, yeah, doesn't everybody?" I mean, that's what I thought. And, you know, I couldn't. And I go, "Yeah, I think about it all the time." "Well, how many times a day do you think about it?" "Oh, gosh, all the time, probably a couple times an hour." And they go, "Well,
wow."
She goes, "Well, have you ever tried that?" And I go, "Well, no, but I've thought about it, but here's my problem is I can't figure out how to kill myself without hurting myself." And they're like, they laughed, you know, because I made it funny. And I said, "No, really. So I'm afraid if I try to run myself off of the cliff, that then what happens is that I don't actually kill myself, and, you know, I'm half here and half not, and they have to send me back to Odessa, Texas, where I grew up, and my mother would have to care for me, and that would be worse than killing myself, you know, to go back to Odessa. You know, that would be the worst thing that could happen to me. Or if I tried to another way, you know, I try to shoot myself, I'd miss, I'd be, you know, half brain dead." And that was my great fear, is not doing a complete job. And so I didn't do anything. Well, the main reason I didn't is because, one, is I had a praying mother. Two is that I knew that I couldn't leave my mom because she was my best friend. If I did anything like that, it would break her heart, and I couldn't do that. So I just thought about it all the time. So, you know, but that's still a big, big symptom. And so, you know, that's not normal. I know now, you know, that it's not normal to think about suicide. And it's not normality. It's depression, because when those voices are coming to you, then that is the enemy telling you that your life is not valuable. But being a Christian, I know my life is extremely valuable, because Jesus paid for my life with his own life. And so that makes my life valuable, because it was paid and bought for, and that he wants me to affect the world cause. And his cause is that he loves every single person. Every single person listening or not listening to this radio show, he loves you so much that he died for you. And so I know that, and so that's what makes my life valuable. And that's why those voices coming to me and those whispers and those things that I was thinking about, that was not God's plan for my life. So that day, she started me, Dr. Terry started me on a brand new drug called Paxil. We now are very familiar with Paxil, but it really worked for my body. And within really, it's supposed to only, you know, start working in 2 or 3 weeks, but really within the first 4 or 5 days, all of a sudden, all of that was gone. My depression, it was just like, wow, this is what life is like before I got depressed. I remember this, you know, and so I came back. And so I was on Paxil for many years, for probably, let's see, for probably 10 years. And then after that, I had moved to Dallas. I was going to a great church, and I felt like the Lord said it's time to get off Paxil. And so the Lord just did a beautiful thing for me and helped me get off of it. And there's a responsible way to get off of that, if your body is ready. And so, and I did, and so I did not take any antidepressant for many years, until when my brother and my mom died. And then that whole chemical thing happened because of me, like I said earlier, I didn't really face that. Then I went back on for just really about a year, and then God took me off of it again. And I'm doing great. I don't have any issues. And really, a lot of mine is just, it's really kind of a supernatural thing. He just blessed me and gifted me with being able to walk out of that. And really, it's a supernatural gift, in my opinion, that God just gave me. Just some people will be on it for years, and I have no judgment. I have no judgment, because I was on it, and it really just changed me and helped me to live a successful life. And help me to be positive. And sometimes it's just a chemical that our body is not making that antidepressants help restore. And so I have no judgments about it one way or the other. And but if you can be off of it and God opens that door and you have the ability, I mean, there were some challenges walking off of it, no doubt about it, but I'm glad I did, and I feel great. Things are great today for me.
Well, that's a great story. You know, I've found from my experience, especially in the church, because I've been counseling for years, that a lot of Christians don't think that you're allowed to take antidepressants, that, you know, it's a drug, and they don't understand it. And I didn't really understand it either until my wife had a stroke, and they told me that something chemically was going on in the brain, and they wanted to put her on Zoloft because, you know, she was depressed all the time, and they were worried about her medication. Do you keep it within her reach, you know, and started me thinking, you know, oh my gosh, you know, am I going to wake up and find her like overdose beside me, or am I going to come home from work and find her, you know, on the floor?
Sure.
So they prescribed a small dose of Zoloft at the time. And she's been taking that, and amazingly, her whole attitude changed, and that was very instrumental in her coming out of the grief process and depression, because all of a sudden, she took ownership of this new home. See, we lived in Burbank, and we lived in this palace that she was determined, this is the house I'm going to die in, just bury me in the backyard, you know. But when we, when she had a stroke, we had to move closer to my work because either my work was suffering or she was suffering. We had to get it closer. It was a two-story house. It wasn't practical. So we literally moved her out kicking and screaming because she did not want to move.
Yeah.
And so when she finally, it took 2 years for her, she at least says, well, let me pick out the house. If we have to move, I want to pick it out, you know, typical Charlene. And so she picked out a beautiful house, half the size. And for 2 years, she would always complain, oh, it's so small, it's like a closet. Well, it's just not. It's 1,600, 1,700 square feet, which is plenty of room for two people. But the point of my story is that after she got out of this and was on the medication, she started coming back to life, you know. She had taken ownership of the home. All of a sudden, she wanted to decorate it. She wanted to paint the walls. She wanted to put window dressing on. She wanted to have people over, start doing dinner parties again. You know, all the things. She's an amazing gourmet cook. She's an interior decorator. She's a hairdresser. All of a sudden, she started blossoming again and became even more amazing than she was before, because now she's doing it with one arm and one leg tied behind her back and duct tape over her mouth. You know, makes us normal people look like whiners and complainers. I can't complain about anything, my achy foot or anything, because she looks at me and she goes, you know, what's your problem? You know, try living 24 hours in my shoes, buddy. You know.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
She says that non-verbally, of course. I'm translating.
Well, I want to say one thing, too, that I think is a really powerful thing in this whole caregiving world here that people are talking about, is that one of the things that my sister-in-law did not do was that, you know, is that lots of times caregivers start treating the care receivers like they're no longer viable, that they're no longer able to do things. And really kind of just, it's like you need to shut up and be quiet and accept what you're given, and, you know, you really can't contribute to the world anymore. And that is, I think, one of the number one mistakes primary caregivers give, that actually Plan B caregivers, those Plan B people, they're the ones that keep suggesting to the primary caregivers, hey, can you do this? Hey, can you maybe take them out? Hey, maybe they can do this or that. And it's very irritating most of the time to the primary caregiver because they just want to get their chores done and get it done, have no kind of changes or no kind of additional issues to deal with. But the care receiver, they still want to live life. And so I think that's another place of resentment that comes up between the primary caregiver and the Plan B person, is the Plan B person will actually listen to the care receiver and encourage them to live life. And that's one of the great things that Charlene does. I tell you, she lives more life in her disability than most people with full abilities do. And
yes,
so, you know, and part of that is because, number one, she was going to, so Dave was going to have to get on board. she was going to do that. But also Dave, because I've been in a situation when I have been there with you guys and wanted to help her, and Dave was like, no, she can do it. And so that's a discipline the primary caregiver has to do, is they have to discipline themselves to allow the person who needs care to do more than this challenges them. And so sometimes we want to take away the challenge, but what good are we doing to the care receiver if we take away all their challenges in life? There's no need to live life if you don't have any challenge.
We're making them dependent on us instead of independent.
Exactly.
And this is a good note.
You do a really good job of that, Dave. You do a really good job of that.
Thank you. I've been complimented by many occupational therapists that I have a very good therapy-minded behavior around her. You know, like she'll be reaching for something in the cupboard. And, you know, normally you would go and say, oh, let me get that for you. But no, I'll say, okay, just stand on your toes. You're almost there. Come on, you can reach it. You can do this. You know, we have a one-handed can opener that she uses all the time. She just puts it on top of the can, pushes a button, and it spins around. She has a lot of little tools around
the
kitchen.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah. And because she's a gourmet cook, I mean, she is cooking every single day of the week. I should be 500 pounds the way I eat. But, you know, I have my bicycle and I ride the calories off. But this would be a good time to bring on a caller. This woman was a caregiver herself for many, many, many years. And this woman happens to be my wife's mother. And I noticed she's on the line. Let me see if she's willing to talk to us and share some of her wisdom. Hello, are you there, Mary?
I'm here.
Oh, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Sorry you had trouble.
Nice to meet you, Mary. That was my mommy's name.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah. It's a grand old name, isn't it?
It is.
It's
the best of the best had it. The best of the best had it.
Very true. Very true.
Why don't you take a few minutes and just introduce us to yourself? We don't have much time, but give us the abbreviated version of your life.
Well, right now I'm 91 years old right now.
Wow.
And I've seen a lot, had a lot, done a lot in my lifetime. When I was first married out of high school, 10 months later I had a beautiful baby boy, the picture of health. He was absolutely a perfect baby if there ever was one. And a year later, I had another baby, and this baby was as sick as he was well. She had cystic fibrosis. And both parents have to be a carrier for a child to have cystic fibrosis. So I lost her when she was 16 months old. I had never witnessed death. I was beside myself, and I was very young, and it was a very difficult time for me to go through. But shortly after that, I became pregnant again, and I had twin baby girls the following year. And one of those twins was Charlene. They were paternal. The other twin had cystic fibrosis, and I lost her at 16 months.
Wow. Tough.
So there I was with my little two-year-old boy and my baby girl that was also the picture of health. She was as well as the other one was sick and vice versa. It was very, very hard for me back in those years. I had no help, and it was extremely hard. And my grandmother told me, she says, well, honey, she says, you know, God has to have rosebuds in heaven the same as he does a full garden. And that, I think, helped me so much because I can picture those babies as rosebuds in heaven. And I knew where they were. I knew where they were and still do. And later on in life, as time went on, when I became older, my mother... first, my father became very ill, and I helped my mother with him. He was diabetic. He had been an alcoholic in his younger years, and he had ruined his health. So we had to go through that, and we lost him. So that was death again that I witnessed. And then before that, my grandfather. So I felt like, my goodness, everyone I love in this world is just leaving. Well, I became the caregiver then for my mother. My mother came to live with me. And right after my father passed away, my mother-in-law came to live with us, with my husband and myself. So we had hospital beds in both of our front bedrooms and took care of both of our mothers until they were gone.
Wow.
And they were Christians. We knew where they were. We just, you know, this. When we have something like this to look forward to, we know, and it helps us to actually accept what has happened. That they are gone, and we know where they are, and that was a blessing, a true blessing. And my husband's brother happens to be a minister, and he was a he was so great around, with the exception of the babies, but our mothers and my father, he was just absolutely our pillar at that time. So that made not only myself, but my brothers and my sister, it made us all just feel so much better, because we knew where they were, we knew where they were gone, we knew
yes.
that, we knew in our hearts that we would see them again. And I had felt that about my two little girls that I had lost. Well, prior to taking care of Charlene for 2 years, this is what had gone on in my life. And then when Charlene had the stroke, that was absolutely a blow, because I thought, oh my goodness, here I had four children, and here my precious daughter has suffered a stroke, and her little twin was 16 months old when I lost her. So that also was just devastating to learn that she had that stroke. So we went down to help David. Rebecca called one day, and she said, Grandma, she says, Daddy is crying, and he wants to talk to you. And David at that time said, mm-hmm. Oh, can you please come? Because he says, I need you as badly as Charlene does. And he did. He did. He was practically burned out. So my husband and I went down and stayed the 2 years until she could become adjusted. And while we were there, I went with her to some of her classes, and the speech therapist came to the house. And I worked with her and worked with her, and I taught her to say three words that she still to this day says, and that is, I love you.
Yes.
And I worked and worked with her and showed her how to form her mouth until she learned to say, I love you. But when we went
I've been on the other end of that many times.
Oh,
so
yes.
Thank you.
Everybody gets that now. Everybody gets, I love you, I love you. She never forgot that, never. And I told her, I said, when we go to church Sunday, I said, I want, we'll go up to Pastor Neil, and I said, I want you to tell him those three words. So we did. When we went to church, we walked up to the front when everyone was greeting him, and I said, Pastor Neil, I said, Charlene has something she wants to tell you. He said, she does? And I said, oh, yes, she wants to tell you. And she looked at me, and then she looked over at him, and she said, I loved you. And he had tears in his eyes, and he said, oh, Charlene, he says, I love you too.
Yes.
And it's a blessing to me, because to this day she has not forgotten those three words. And everybody that she meets and loves, get those three words.
So, well, thank you so much, Mary. Thank you for calling in and sharing that heartwarming story. We appreciate it. And yes, I hear those words constantly, multiple
yes.
times a day. And I didn't even realize that you had taught her that. I must have been at
yes,
work.
I worked. Oh, yes. I worked and worked with her on those. And another thing I'd like to say, David,
yeah.
when my husband was here and Debbie and Cindy both came, and they were with me, and I had him here at home,
mm-hmm.
and hospice was in, coming in, and I had been sitting with him, and I thought he was asleep, and I got up to go into the dining room, and Cindy was sitting in there at the table, and so I got up, and when I got up, he said, I love you. First, he said, you're beautiful. He said, I love you. And I said, oh, honey, I said, I love you too. And I walked into the dining room, and I just sat down at the table, and Debbie came in, and she says, Grandma, Grandpa's gone. And I'll tell you, that has helped me, I think, more than anything on this earth to know the words that came from him, because he hadn't been able to talk or anything. And he said, you're beautiful. He said, I love you. And so those words have come back more and more and more to me. So I know all of these loved ones that have gone before, I am going to see them again.
Amen.
Absolutely.
I'm going to see them again.
That's the great hope. And I don't know how people can deal with life without hope like that.
No.
You know, that there
no,
is a God.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And
I
feel
it.
I feel the spirits. I feel the spirit. I feel my husband's spirit every day. Every day. Beautiful memories. I feel. I have not gone through a bad grieving because I knew. I knew where he was going. I know where he is, and that's what helped me. And to
well, thank
know
you.
He left this world saying, "I love you." So, those are important words, David.
Thank you. Yes, yes. My father-in-law had come down with dementia. Started out with some forgetfulness and confusion, and then dementia. And that's what he died of. But he was a very, very healthy man. He survived prostate cancer when they said that he wouldn't because he changed his diet. He was a very, very healthy eater. And he was an amazing man. We're going to see him all in heaven. Thanks for calling
right.
in, and God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless you, too.
You can keep listening on this line.
Okay.
Okay. That was amazing. Lynn?
That was amazing. Yes.
Okay. I was going to say, can you still hear me? But obviously you can. In closing, because we're a little over on our time, thank you for hanging in there with us and being patient. What would be your best advice to primary caregivers and Plan B caregivers on how to manage their respective positions within the family on a daily basis? I don't know if you already covered that, but if you didn't, touch on that if you would.
Well, I think I did pretty much cover it. Basically, it comes down to one word, and that is the word that Mary was just talking about, and that's the word love. It's really to love and respect one another. Because if you do that and you come with that attitude, then you can get through anything together. Mm. You get through anything. But
yeah.
If you resent or dismiss either side, then that's where you're going to have problems. So you have to make the decision. It is an active, proactive decision to love. It's not a passive thing. It's an active thing. So that would be what I would say that you have to decide on a daily basis to do, to love and respect each other.
Amen.
And have grace with each other, I would say. And then there's one other thing we talked about. David, can you remind me?
Yeah, we spoke earlier. You shared a story with me about transitioning to heaven. Can you share that story with our audience before you leave?
Yes. One of the things that there's a couple of stories. Is one is that my mom had me when she was 40 years old, and I'm 62 now. So back in those days, 40-year-old women didn't have children for the most part.
Mm.
And so when I was about 35, I lived in Burbank at the time, and of course, she was 75, and she's just funny, funny, funny. And so one day, and I called her every Saturday because, you know, back in those days, you didn't have unlimited calling. So I called her every Saturday, and we talked for as long as I could afford for us to talk. And so I called her up one day because I got all worked up because I was starting to think about, you know, she's 75, what happens when she dies, you know, and that's how I called her up, and I was like, Mama, what am I going to do when you're dead? What am I going to do when you die? I won't have anybody to pray for me. It was so selfish. And I won't have anybody to pray for me. And she goes, well, first of all, I'm not dead yet. And I just caught me off guard. It's like, oh, yeah, all right, that's right. And she said, she goes, Lynn, she said, when you know Jesus like we do, she said, Jesus is not going to let me leave here until I have done my job with you. So if you have any needs or questions that you would want to ask me, then just ask it out loud. You'll hear my voice because I will have already taught you there because my job will be done. And she said, and if you miss me and you want to tell the Lord, just tell the Lord, I'm missing my mother. You know, what would she say to me now? And the Holy Spirit will reveal that to you. She said, you know, I'm in Odessa now. You're in Burbank now. It'll be the kind of same thing. It's a long-distance relationship. She said, I'll be in heaven. I will just change locations. That's all.
Wow.
That's all. I'll have just changed locations. And so then fast forward to about a week before she passed, I was on the cot, and she was in the hospital. I was on the cot, and maybe it was 2 weeks before she passed. I was on the cot, and we were playing games, you know. Well, maybe it was 3 weeks before she passed, but anyway, whatever. Anyway, we make up games and stuff like that. And so I was asking her questions, and I had my notepad, and I would write down her answers because I wanted to know, I wanted to have that for posterity. And I would say, if you're going through, if you're a caregiver and you're going through, you know, facing that your loved one is about to leave this earth, I would say ask any question that you want to hear what they have to say. Think about it and either record them on your cell phone or write it down. Because it is those questions and reading those answers have really helped me over the years. And so I would ask her these questions. We were just doing that, and all of a sudden she's like looking up, and she starts looking at the ceiling, you know, that how those tile ceilings are in the hospital. She's looking at it really intently. So I'm looking up at the ceiling, like looking at her look at the ceiling, because she wasn't answering my question. And I was looking at that ceiling. We're both looking at that ceiling. She goes, oh, my goodness, the sky is so blue and so beautiful. Oh, it's so beautiful. Lynn, I'm at the top. And I go, first I go, where are you, Mama? And she goes, I'm at the top of the mountain, Lynn. She says, such vivaciousness. And she was like, it's so beautiful up here. Look at that sky. It's so beautiful. Wait a second. I'm looking at the ceiling. We died laughing. Wait a second. I'm looking at this. She looked at me. She goes, what was I just talking about the sky? And I said, well, Mom, you said you're at the top of the mountain. I guess you are. She goes, I guess I am, but it's a ceiling now. So she's back to reality. And what I say, and what when I wrote my mother's obituary, I wrote, Mary Lynn Bowden transitioned to heaven. Because that's how I look at it. I don't look at it anymore that she died, because she's actually more alive now than she ever was here, because she's alive in the spirit there through the Spirit of God. And so now she just transitioned. She just changed locations, as she said. So that's how I look at it, and it has really been a source of help to me and help to others. That it's just they just transition. That's all. We're going to see them again, just like Mary was saying. She's going to see her babies again, and she's going to see her sweetheart again. It's just a transition. That's all it is. And I think that not only will that help in the process, that's what it came out of me processing my grief, is that, you know what, I don't have to stay sad because I know where they are. And one of the things that the pastor said at my mother's funeral is, you know, Mary Lynn's not lost. And when people come up to me and say, when did you lose your mom? Most of the time I go, well, she transitioned. You're not lost if somebody knows where you are. And I know where my mom is. I know where Joe is. I know where my daddy is. And I know where Ben and Otto are. And there's a whole other story I have about that, too. But, you know, I know where they are. So they're not lost. I haven't lost them because I know where they are.
Wow. Lynn, I was hoping to get to more calls, but the interview has just been so interesting. Can we just try one more caller before we leave? I see them here, and let me see if they're on the line. Caller, are you there? Hello? Would you like to ask the guest a question or say anything? Maybe not. Okay. Last chance. going, gone.
And gone.
You know, opportunity knocks once in your lifetime if you're lucky. And if you're not there to seize that opportunity, it's gone. Lynn, thank you so much for coming on
you're
the
so
show
welcome.
And sharing your wisdom. And I just have to say, you've been a great, great friend, Lynn. You know, when I thought you were just going to be a realtor that came and gone in my life, you were so persistent that, no, I want to be your friend, you know, outside of this business relationship. And you have been the best friend that I think I've ever had
Thank
in my
you.
Lifetime. Because I didn't...
Oh,
I
don't, that's so kind.
Well, I didn't know what a real friend is until I met you, because you are like a bulldog or a pit bull that, because, you know, relationships aren't easy, and you and I have had our share of disagreements
sure.
and difficult situations, even in business or personal or whatever.
Sure.
Or, you know, we're both strong-willed, and sometimes, you know, we butt heads and lock horns, but
right.
I've noticed about you, it never affects the friendship, and it's like the dog. You have unconditional love. When you are a friend of Lynn Barrington, you are a lucky, lucky, blessed person, because she will never leave you nor forsake you. And there's only one other person I know like that. And I know that people will eventually leave us and forsake us, but it hasn't happened with Lynn yet. She's just gold. So if you're fortunate enough to be Lynn Barrington's friend, you're a blessed person.
Thank you so much. That is so sweet. And
well,
I try
true.
To be that kind of friend. It doesn't always work out with everybody, but it's pretty easy because, you know, if you act up, then I just talk to Charlene and she straightens you out. So I
yes.
thank you. I feel it's a mutual admiration society here because I feel the same way about you and Charlene. I feel very blessed to have known you and been in your presence and hung out with you guys at your house. And it's just been a very wonderful thing, and hope to do it again soon.
Great.
Yes,
thank it is
you
a mutual so much admiration
for
society.
Me to do this.
Well,
you
know, the great thing about this is that this show is going to be broadcast again and again and again as a podcast and to literally thousands and tens of thousands and who knows, hundreds of thousands of people will be listening to the show worldwide. And
that
is the great thing about Internet radio. So, Lynn, we love you. And thank you, everybody.
And make sure,
yes.
since it's going to go to hundreds of thousands of people, check my website out at lynnbarrington.com.
Yes, absolutely. And check my website at DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com or the short version, DaveNass.com. And my third book is on its way, but, you know, it's going to take a little longer because major publishers and literary agents, when they get involved, it just is a longer process. So be patient. Thank you, Lynn, and God bless you.
Thank you, Dave.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm,
bye.
Bridge of Spring. than to touch you. They'll take your soul if you let them. Oh, now, but don't you let them.
Yeah.
You just call.
Songs so you get people like this to sing them. And like this.